A hearing on the motion was set. The state did, in fact, join our motion to dismiss the charges, and I didn't expect the final hearing to last more than a few minutes. The night before, I'd driven down to Minnie to get a suit for Walter to wear at the hearing, since he would finally be able to walk out of court a free man. When I arrived at her house, she gave me a long hug. It looked like she had been crying and hadn't slept. We sat down, and she told me again how happy she was that they were letting him out. But she looked troubled. Finally, she turned to me. "Brian, I think you need to tell him that maybe he shouldn't come back here. It's just all been too much. The stress, the gossip, the lies, everything. He doesn't deserve what they put him through, and it will hurt me to my heart the rest of my life what they did to him, and the rest of us. But I don't think I can go back to the way things were." "Well, you all should talk when he gets home. We want to have everybody over when he gets out. We want to cook some good food, and everybody will want to celebrate. But after that, maybe he should go to Montgomery with you." I had already talked with Walter about not staying his first few nights in Monroeville for security reasons. We had talked about him spending time with family members in Florida while we monitored the local reaction to his release, but I hadn't discussed his future with Minnie. I kept urging Minnie to talk with Walter when he got home, but it was clear she didn't have the heart for that. I drove back to Montgomery, sadly realizing that even as we stood on the brink of victory and what should have been a glorious release for Walter and his family, this nightmare would likely never be completely over for him. For the first time, I fully reckoned with the truth that the conviction, the death sentence, and the heartbreak and devastation of this miscarriage of justice had created permanent injuries. State, local, and national media outlets were crowded outside the courthouse when I arrived the next morning. Dozens of Walter's family members and friends from the community were there to greet him when he came out. They had made signs and banners which surprised me. They were such simple gestures, but I found myself deeply moved. The signs gave a silent voice to the crowd. "Welcome home, Johnny D. God never fails. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." I went down to the jail and brought Walter his suit. I told him that a celebration was planned at his house after the hearing. The prison had not allowed Walter to bring his possessions to the courthouse, refusing to acknowledge that he might be released, so we would have to go back to Holman Prison to get his things before the homecoming at his house. I also told him that I'd reserved a hotel room for him in Montgomery and that it would probably be safest to spend the next few nights there. I reluctantly talked to him about my conversation with Minnie. He seemed surprised and hurt, but he didn't linger on it. "This is a really happy day for me. Nothing can really spoil getting your freedom back." "Well, y'all should talk at some point," I urged. I went upstairs to find Tommy Chapman waiting for me in the courtroom. "After we're done, I'd like to shake his hand," he told me. "Would that be all right?" "I think he'd appreciate that. This case has taught me things I didn't even know I had to learn." "We've all learned a lot, Tommy." There were deputy sheriffs everywhere. When Bernard arrived, we consulted briefly at the council table before a bailiff asked us to go back to the judge's chambers. Judge Norton had retired weeks before the ruling from the Court of Criminal Appeals. The new judge, Pamela Bashab, greeted me warmly. We made small talk and then discussed what would happen during the hearing. Everyone was strangely pleasant. "Mr. Stevenson, if you'll just present the motion and provide a brief summary, I don't need any arguments or statements. I intend to grant the motion immediately so you all can get home. We can get this done quickly." We went into the courtroom. There seemed to be more black deputies in the courtroom for this hearing than I'd ever seen in my appearances in that courthouse. There was no metal detector, no menacing dog. The courtroom was packed with Walter's family members and supporters. There were more cheering black folks outside the courthouse who couldn't get in. A horde of television cameras and journalists spilled out of the crowded courtroom. They finally brought Walter into the courtroom wearing the black suit and white shirt I'd brought him. He looked handsome and fit, like a different man. The deputies didn't handcuff Walter or shackle him, so he walked into court waving to family and friends. His family had not seen him dressed in anything but his white prison uniform since the trial 6 years earlier, and many in the crowd gasped when he walked into the courtroom in a suit. For years, Walter's family members and supporters had been confronted with menacing stares and threats of expulsion whenever they expressed some spontaneous opinion during court proceedings. But today, the deputies accepted their expressive cheerfulness in silence. The judge took the bench, and I stepped forward to speak. I gave a brief history of the case and informed the court that both the defendant and the state were moving the court to dismiss all charges. The judge quickly granted the motion and asked if there was anything further. All of a sudden, I felt strangely agitated. I'd expected to be exuberant. Everyone was in such a good mood. The judge and the prosecutor were suddenly generous and accommodating. It was as if everyone wanted to be sure there were no hard feelings or grudges. Walter was rightfully ecstatic, but I was confused by my suddenly simmering anger. We were about to leave court for the last time, and I started thinking about how much pain and suffering had been inflicted on Walter and his family, the entire community. I thought about how, if Judge Robert E. Lee Key hadn't overridden the jury's verdict of life imprisonment without parole and imposed the death penalty, which brought the case to our attention, Walter likely would have spent the rest of his life incarcerated and died in a prison cell. I thought about how certain it was that hundreds, maybe thousands of other people were just as innocent as Walter, but would never get the help they need. I knew this wasn't the place or time to make a speech or complain, but I couldn't stop myself from making one final comment. Your Honor, I just want to say this before we adjourn. It was far too easy to convict this wrongly accused man for murder and send him to death row for something he didn't do, and much too hard to win his freedom after proving his innocence. We have serious problems and important work that must be done in this state. I sat down and the judge pronounced Walter free to go. Just like that, he was a free man. Walter hugged me tightly, and I gave him a handkerchief to wipe the tears from his eyes. I led him over to Chapman, and they shook hands. The black deputies who had hovered nearby ushered us toward a back door that led downstairs, where a throng of reporters waited. One of the deputies patted me on the back, declaring, "That's awesome, man, that's awesome." I asked Bernard to tell the family and supporters that we would meet them out front. Walter stood very close to me as we answered questions from the press. I could tell he was feeling overwhelmed, so I cut off the questions after a few minutes, and we walked to the front door of the courthouse. TV camera crews followed us. As we walked outside, dozens of people cheered and waved their signs. Walter's relatives ran up to him to hug him, and they hugged me too. Walter's grandchildren grabbed his hands. Older people I hadn't previously met came up to hug him. Walter couldn't believe how many people were there for him. He hugged everyone. Even when some of the men came up to shake his hand, he gave them a hug. I told everyone that Bernard and I had to take Walter to the prison and that we would come to the house directly from there. It took nearly an hour to get through the crowd and into the car. On the drive to the prison, Walter told me that the men on death row had held a special service for him on his last night. They had come to pray for him and give him their final hugs. Walter said he felt guilty leaving them behind. I told him not to. They were all thrilled to know he was going home. His freedom was, in a small way, a sign of hope in a hopeless place. Despite my assurances that we'd be at the house shortly, everyone followed us to the prison. The press, the local TV crews, the family, everyone. When we got to Holman, a caravan of media and well-wishers trailed behind us. I parked and walked to the front gate to explain to the guard in the tower that I didn't have anything to do with all of the people. I knew that the warden had strict policies about the presence of people who didn't have business at the prison, but the guard waved us inside. No one tried to get the crowd to leave. We went to the prison office to collect Walter's possessions, his legal materials and correspondence with me, letters from family and supporters, a Bible, the Timex watch he was wearing when he was arrested, and the wallet he had had with him back in June 1987 when his nightmare began. The wallet still had $23 in it. Walter had given to other death row prisoners his fan, a dictionary, and the food items he had in his cell. I saw the warden peering at us from his office as we collected Walter's things, but he didn't come out. A few guards watched as we walked out the front gate of the prison. Lots of people were still gathered outside. I saw Mrs. Williams. Walter went up to her and gave her a hug. When their embrace released, she looked over and winked at me. I couldn't help but laugh. Men in their cells could see the crowd outside and started shouting encouragement to Walter as he walked away. We couldn't see them from outside the prison, but their voices rang out just the same. The voices were haunting because they were disembodied, but they were full of excitement and hopefulness. One of the last voices we heard was a man shouting, "Stay strong, man! Stay strong!" Walter shouted back, "All right!" As he walked to the car, Walter raised his arms and gently moved them up and down as if he meant to take flight. He looked at me and said, "I feel like a bird. I feel like a bird." Chapter 12. Mother, Mother. On a cool, crisp, mid-March evening, Marcia Colby stepped out onto the streets of New York City in an elegant royal blue gown with her husband beside her. She had dreamed of a moment like this for years. She took in the sights and sounds with great curiosity as they strolled down the busy sidewalks. Enormous buildings stretched to the sky in the distance while raucous traffic whizzed through the Greenwich Village streets. The clusters of New York students and artisans paid them no mind as they made their way through Washington Square Park. She noticed an amateur jazz trio laboring through standards on a park corner. It all seemed like something out of a movie. A white woman from a poor, rural Alabama town, Marcia had never been to New York, but she was about to be honored at a dinner with 200 guests. It was all exciting. But she was experiencing something unusual as she made her way to the venue. She soon sorted out what she was feeling. Freedom. She was wandering the streets of the world's most dazzling city with her husband, and she was free. It was a glorious feeling. Everything in the last 3 months since her release had been magical. It was beyond what she could have imagined even before she was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole at the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women. When Hurricane Ivan hit coastal Alabama and blew chaos and calamity into Marcia's life, she thought things were as bad as they could get. Ivan spawned 119 tornadoes and created over $18 billion in damage. With 6 children to protect, she had no time to panic over the loss of their home or the violent destruction of everything around them. It was the uncertainty that worried Marcia. Where would she or her husband find work? How long would the kids be out of school? What would they do for money? What would they do for food? Everyone on the Gulf Coast was feeling vulnerable in the face of such an uncertain future. The constant wave of tropical storms and hurricanes that menaced coastal Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida in the summer of 2004 turned their relaxed southern coastal life into an apocalyptic struggle for survival. Marcia and Glenn Colby were living in a crowded trailer with their children, and they knew they were at risk when the hurricane warnings were announced. They weren't alone. Plenty of other families shared their situation, which offered some consolation. But when Ivan destroyed the Colby home in September, there was little comfort in finding herself in line with thousands of other people seeking assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Aid eventually came. The Colbys were given a FEMA camper trailer as temporary housing, and they put it on their property so the kids could stay in their nearby schools. Marcia and Glenn had found construction work and roofing jobs at the start of the summer, but now it would be weeks before rebuilding jobs would be available. Marcia could also tell that she was pregnant. She was 43 years old and hadn't planned on having another child. All she could think about was how, in a few months, the pregnancy would limit her ability to do construction work. Her worry sometimes tipped over into a deeper anxiety that triggered an old temptation, drugs. but there were too many people depending on her, and there was too much to manage to give in. 5 years earlier, police were called after nurses had found cocaine in her system when she was pregnant with her youngest son, Joshua, and the authorities had terrified her with accusations and threats of criminal prosecution, imprisonment, and the seizure of her children. She was not going to risk that again. She and Glenn were dirt poor, but Marcia had always compensated for the things she couldn't give her kids by giving them all of her heart. She read to them, talked to them, played with them, hugged and kissed them constantly, and kept them close at all times. Against all odds, she nurtured a precious family bonded by an intense love. Her older boys, even her 19-year-old, stayed close to her at home despite the many distractions that emerged as they finished high school. Marcia liked being a mom. It's why she didn't worry about having so many kids. Getting pregnant with a seventh was not what she had expected or preferred, but she would love this child as she had loved each one before. By winter, things in Baldwin County had settled down. Jobs had returned, and Glenn finally found more steady work. The family was still struggling financially, but most of the kids were back in school, and it seemed as if they had survived the worst of the destruction. Marcia knew that a pregnancy at her age was very risky, but she couldn't afford to see a doctor. She just didn't have the money to spare. Having endured 6 previous deliveries, she knew what to expect and thought she'd make the best of it without prenatal care. She tried not to worry, even though she'd been experiencing some pains and problems with this pregnancy that she didn't remember having before. There had been bleeding. If she could have afforded an examination, a doctor would have found signs of placental abruption. Their old trailer sat next to the new FEMA camper and was largely uninhabitable, but it still had running water and a bathtub, which afforded Marcia a quiet getaway from time to time. One day, she wasn't feeling well and thought a long, hot bath would do her good. She settled into a tub of hot water minutes before a violent labor began. She sensed it was happening too fast, and before she knew it, she delivered a stillborn son. She desperately tried to revive the infant, but he never took a breath. Although she'd initially fretted about the pregnancy, Marcia mourned the baby's death and insisted on giving him a name and a family burial. They named him Timothy and buried him in a marked grave beside their small camper home. The baby's stillbirth might have remained a private tragedy for Marcia and her family had it not been for a nosy neighbor who had long been suspicious of the Colbys. Debbie Cook noticed that Marcia Colby was no longer pregnant, but did not have a baby, which stirred her interest in the details of the stillbirth. Marcia didn't trust the woman, and was evasive when she made inquiries. Cook, who worked at the elementary school attended by Mrs. Colby's children, eventually instructed one of the school cafeteria workers to call the police about the absent infant. Officer Kenneth Llewellyn spoke with Ms. Cook and then went to Ms. Colby's home. Marcia, still grieving the loss of her baby and frustrated by the meddling, reacted badly to the police questioning. She initially attempted to misdirect the officer and the investigators in an effort to protect her privacy. It wasn't a smart thing to do, but she was outraged by their prodding. When Llewellyn noticed the marked grave beside the Colby's home, Marcia admitted it was the burial site for her recently delivered stillborn son. Kathleen Instance, a forensic pathologist who worked for the state, was summoned to exhume the infant's body. Marcia was shocked that law enforcement would do something so upsetting without justification. As soon as the baby was exhumed, but before she had an opportunity to formally examine the body, Enstis told an investigator that she believed that the baby had been born alive. She later conceded that she had no basis for such an opinion, and that without an autopsy and tests, there was no way she could know if a baby had been born alive. As it turned out, Enstis had a history of prematurely and incorrectly declaring deaths to be homicides without adequate supporting evidence. The pathologist subsequently performed an autopsy at the Department of Forensic Sciences Laboratory in Mobile. She not only concluded that Marcia Colby's baby was born alive, but also asserted that the child would have survived with medical attention. Even though most experts agree that forensic pathologists who primarily deal with dead people are not qualified to estimate survival chances, the state allowed prosecutors to pursue criminal charges. Unbelievably, Marcia Colby, a few short weeks after delivering her stillborn son, found herself arrested and charged with capital murder. Alabama is among the growing list of states that make the murder of a person under the age of 14 a capital offense punishable by the death penalty. The child victim category resulted in a tremendous increase in the number of young mothers and juveniles who were sent to death row. All five women on Alabama's death row were condemned for the unexplained deaths of their young children or the deaths of abusive spouses or boyfriends, all of them. In fact, nationwide, most women on death row are awaiting execution for a family crime involving an allegation of child abuse or domestic violence involving a male partner. At trial, Kathleen Instis testified that Timothy was born alive and had died by drowning. She testified that her conclusion of a live birth was a diagnosis of exclusion. That is, she could not find evidence that the baby was stillborn and did not have another explanation for his death. Her testimony was exposed as unreliable by the state's own expert witness, Dr. Dennis McNally, an obstetrician, gynecologist who examined Mrs. Colby 2 weeks after the stillbirth. Dr. McNally testified that Mrs. Colby's pregnancy was at high risk for unexplained fetal death because of her age and lack of prenatal care. Instis' conclusion was further discredited by Dr. Werner Spitz, who had authored the medical treatise Instis had relied on in her forensic pathology training. Dr. Spitz testified for the defense that he would absolutely not declare a live birth, let alone a homicide, under the circumstances of this case. With no credible scientific evidence that a crime had occurred, the state introduced inflammatory evidence that Marcia was poor, a prior drug user, and obviously a bad mother for not seeking prenatal care. Police investigators went into her home and took photographs of an unflushed toilet and a beer can on the floor, which were waved in front of the jury as evidence of neglect and bad parenting. Mrs. Colby consistently maintained during multiple interrogations that the baby was stillborn. She told investigators that her son was born dead and never took a breath, despite her efforts to revive him. Mrs. Colby rejected the state's offer of a plea agreement, pursuant to which she would have gone to prison for 18 years because she was adamant that she had done nothing wrong. The prosecution of Marcia Colby eventually caught the attention of the press, which was titillated by another dangerous mother story. The crime was sensationalized by the local media, which lauded the police and prosecutor for coming to the aid of a defenseless infant. Demonizing irresponsible mothers had become a media craze by the time Marcia's trial was scheduled. Tragic narratives of mothers killing their children were national sensations. When Andrea Yates drowned her five children in Texas in 2001, the tragedy became a national story. Susan Smith's effort to blame random black men for the death of her children in South Carolina before later admitting to murdering them fascinated crime-obsessed Americans. In time, media interest in these kinds of stories grew into a national preoccupation. Time magazine called the prosecution of Casey Anthony, the young Florida mother ultimately acquitted in the death of her two-year-old daughter, the social media trial of the century, after the story generated nonstop coverage on cable networks. The murder of a child by a parent is horrific and is usually complicated by serious mental illness, as in the Yates and Smith cases. But these cases also tend to create distortions and bias. Police and prosecutors have been influenced by the media coverage, and a presumption of guilt has now fallen on thousands of women, particularly poor women in difficult circumstances, whose children die unexpectedly. Despite America's preeminent status among developed nations, we have always struggled with high rates of infant mortality, much higher than in most developed countries. The inability of many poor women to get adequate health care, including prenatal and postpartum care, has been a serious problem in this country for decades. Even with recent improvements, infant mortality rates continue to be an embarrassment for a nation that spends more on health care than any other country in the world. The criminalization of infant mortality and the persecution of poor women whose children die have taken on new dimensions in 21st century America, as prisons across the country began to bear witness. Communities were on the lookout for bad moms who should be put in prison. About the same time as Marsha's prosecution, Bridget Lee gave birth to a stillborn baby in Pickens County, Alabama. She was charged with capital murder and wrongfully imprisoned. Lee, a church pianist, mother of two, and bank bookkeeper, had gotten pregnant after an extramarital affair. Scared and depressed, the 34-year-old hid her pregnancy and hoped to secretly put the child up for adoption. But she went into labor 5 weeks before her due date, and the baby was stillborn. She didn't tell her husband about the stillbirth, which aroused suspicion. The disreputable circumstances surrounding Lee's pregnancy were enough to influence the pathologist who conducted the autopsy to conclude that the stillborn baby was born alive and was then suffocated by Lee. Months after Lee was arrested and charged with capital murder, six additional pathologists examined the body and unanimously concluded that neonatal pneumonia had killed the child. It was a classic stillbirth with very common features. This new information led the prosecutor to drop the charges, sparing Ms. Lee a capital trial and potentially the death penalty. The discredited pathologist left Alabama, but continues to serve as a practicing medical examiner in Texas. In hundreds of other cases, falsely accused women never received the forensic help they needed to avoid wrongful convictions. A few years earlier, before representing Marsha Colby, we took on the case of Diane Tucker and Victoria Banks, an intellectually disabled black woman living in Choctaw County, Alabama. Ms. Banks was accused of killing her newborn child even though police had no credible basis for believing she had ever been pregnant. Banks had allegedly told a deputy sheriff that she was pregnant to avoid time in jail for an unrelated matter. When she was seen months later with no child, police accused her of killing her infant. Disabled and without adequate legal assistance, Ms. Banks was coerced into pleading guilty to killing a child who had never existed, along with her sister, Ms. Tucker. Because she was facing capital murder charges and a potential death sentence, she made a deal to accept a prison sentence of 20 years. Law enforcement officials refused to investigate her claims of innocence prior to sending her to prison. We won her freedom after establishing that she had had a tubal ligation 5 years prior to her arrest, which made it biologically impossible for her to conceive, let alone give birth to, a child. In addition to unexplained deaths of infants parented by poor women, other kinds of bad parenting have also been criminalized. In 2006, Alabama passed a law that made it a felony to expose a child to a dangerous environment in which the child could encounter drugs. This child chemical endangerment statute was ostensibly passed to protect children living in households where there were meth labs or drug trafficking operations. But the law was applied much more broadly, and soon thousands of mothers with children living in poor, marginalized communities where drugs and drug addiction are rampant were at risk of prosecution. In time, the Alabama Supreme Court interpreted the term environment to include the womb and the term child to include a fetus. Pregnant women could now be criminally prosecuted and sent to prison for decades if there was any evidence that they had used drugs at any point during their pregnancy. Dozens of women have been sent to prison under this law in recent years, rather than getting the help they needed. The hysteria surrounding bad mothers made a fair trial for Marsha Colby very difficult. During jury selection, numerous jurors announced that they could not be impartial toward Ms. Colby. Some jurors indicated that they found allegations of killing a child so disturbing that they could not honor the presumption of innocence. Several revealed that they had such a close relationship with one of the state investigators, a key state witness who had been especially vocal about identifying bad mothers, that they would give him instant credibility and would, quote, believe everything he said was credible, end quote. Another juror admitted trusting law enforcement witnesses he knew to the point where he would, quote, believe anything they say, end quote. The trial court allowed almost all of these jurors to remain on the jury panel despite defense objections. Ultimately, a jury who brought many presumptions and biases to the trial of Marcia Colby was selected to decide her fate. The jury returned a verdict of guilty on one count of capital murder. Prior to rendering a verdict, jurors expressed concerns about Mrs. Colby being subject to the death penalty, so the state agreed not to pursue an execution if she was found guilty. This concession yielded an immediate conviction. The trial court sentenced Mrs. Colby to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, and a short while later, she found herself shackled in a prison van, heading to the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women. Built in the 1940s, Tutwiler Prison is situated in Wetumpka, Alabama. Named after a woman who promoted the education of prisoners and championed humane conditions of confinement, Tutwiler has become an overcrowded, dangerous nightmare for the women trapped there. Courts have repeatedly found the prison unconstitutionally overcrowded, with almost twice the number of women incarcerated as it was designed to hold. In the United States, the number of women sent to prison increased 646% between 1980 and 2010, a rate of increase 1.5 times higher than the rate for men. With close to 200,000 women in jails and prisons in America, and over 1 million women under the supervision or control of the criminal justice system, the incarceration of women has reached record levels. At Tutwiler, women are crammed into dormitories and improvised living spaces. Marcia was shocked by the overcrowding. As the only state prison for women, Tutwiler has no way to meaningfully classify and assign women to appropriate dorms. Women battling serious mental illness or severe emotional problems are thrown in with other women, making dorm life chaotic and stressful for everyone. Marcia could never quite get used to hearing women screaming and hollering inexplicably throughout the night in a crowded dorm. Most incarcerated women, nearly two-thirds, are in prison for nonviolent, low-level drug crimes or property crimes. Drug laws, in particular, have had a huge impact on the number of women sent to prison. Three strikes laws have also played a considerable role. I started challenging conditions of confinement at Tutwiler in the mid-1980s as a young attorney with the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. At the time, I was shocked to find women in prison for such minor offenses. One of the first incarcerated women I ever met was a young mother who was serving a long prison sentence for writing checks to buy her three young children Christmas gifts without sufficient funds in her account. Like a character in a Victor Hugo novel, she tearfully explained her heartbreaking tale to me. I couldn't accept the truth of what she was saying until I checked her file and discovered that she had, in fact, been convicted and sentenced to over 10 years in prison for writing five checks, including three to Toys R Us. None of the checks was for more than $150. She was not unique. Thousands of women have been sentenced to lengthy terms in prison for writing bad checks or for minor property crimes that trigger mandatory minimum sentences. The collateral consequences of incarcerating women are significant. Approximately 75 to 80% of incarcerated women are mothers with minor children. Nearly 65% had minor children living with them at the time of their arrest, children who have become more vulnerable and at risk as a result of their mother's incarceration, and will remain so for the rest of their lives, even after their mothers come home. In 1996, Congress passed welfare reform legislation that gratuitously included a provision that authorized states to ban people with drug convictions from public benefits and welfare. The population most affected by this misguided law is formerly incarcerated women with children, most of whom were in prison for drug crimes. These women and their children can no longer live in public housing, receive food stamps, or access basic services. In the last 20 years, we've created a new class of untouchables in American society, made up of our most vulnerable mothers and their children. Marcia wandered through her first days at Tutwiler in a state of disbelief. She met other women like herself who had been imprisoned after having given birth to stillborn babies. Afernia McClendon, a young black teenager from Opelika, Alabama, got pregnant in high school and didn't tell her parents. She delivered at just over 5 months and left the stillborn baby's remains in a drainage ditch. When they were discovered, she was interrogated by police until she acknowledged that she couldn't be 100% sure the infant hadn't moved before death, even though the premature delivery made viability extremely unlikely. Threatened with the death penalty, she joined a growing community of women in prison for having unplanned pregnancies and bad judgment. The lives and the suffering of the women got tangled together at Tutwiler. For Marcia, it was impossible not to notice that some women never got visits. She tried at first, but couldn't remain indifferent to the people around her who seemed in acute distress, those who cried more than usual, or who suffered the greatest anxiety about the children or parents they'd left behind, or who seemed especially down or depressed. Knitted together as they were, a horrible day for one woman would inevitably become a horrible day for everyone. The only consolation in such an arrangement was that joyous moments were shared as well. A grant of parole, the arrival of a hoped-for letter, a visit from a long-absent family member would lift everyone's spirits. If the struggles of the other women had been Marcia's biggest challenge at Tutwiler, her years there would have been difficult but manageable. But there were bigger problems coming from the correctional staff itself. Women at Tutwiler were being raped by prison guards. Women were being sexually harassed, exploited, abused, and assaulted by male officers in countless ways. The male warden allowed the male guards entry into the showers during prison counts. Officers leered at the naked women and made crude comments and suggestive threats. Women had no privacy in the bathrooms where male officers could watch them use the toilet. There were dark corners and hallways, terrifying spaces at Tutwiler, where women could be beaten or sexually assaulted. EJI had asked the Department of Corrections to install security cameras in the dorms, but they refused. The culture of sexual violence was so pervasive that even the prison chaplain was sexually assaulting women when they came to the chapel. Shortly after Marcia arrived at Tutwiler, we won the release of Diane Jones, who had been wrongly convicted and sentenced to die in prison for a crime she had not committed. Diane had been wrongly implicated in a drug trafficking operation that involved her former boyfriend. She was convicted of multiple charges that triggered a sentence of mandatory life imprisonment without parole. We challenged her conviction and sentence and ultimately won her release. The release of Diane Jones, a condemned lifer, gave hope to all of the other lifers at Tutwiler. I received letters from women I'd never met thanking me for helping her. While working on her case, I'd go to Tutwiler to meet with Diane, who would tell me how the women were desperate for help. "Brian, I have about 9 notes people want me to pass to you. It was too many to get past the guard, so I didn't bring them, but these women want your help." "Well, don't try to smuggle notes. They can write us." "Well, some say they have written." "We're swamped, Diane. I'm sorry, but we'll try to reply." "I'm mostly worried about the lifers. They're the ones who will die in here." "We're trying. There's only so much we can do." "I tell them that. I know. They're just desperate. Like I was desperate before y'all helped me. Marcia, Ashley, Monica, Patricia are sweating me to have you send someone to help." We met Marcia Colby shortly after that and began working on her appeal. We decided to challenge the state's case and the way the jury had been selected. Charlotte Morrison, a Rhodes Scholar and former student of mine, was now a senior attorney at EJI. She and staff attorney Kristen Nelson, a Harvard law grad who had worked at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia, the nation's premier public defender office, met with Marcia repeatedly. She would talk about her case, the challenge of keeping her family together while she was in prison, and a range of other problems. But it was the sexual violence at Tutwiler that most frequently came up during these visits. Charlotte and I took on the case of another woman who had filed a federal civil suit after she was raped at Tutwiler. She had had no legal help. Because of defects in her pleadings and the allegations she made in her complaint, we could secure only a small settlement judgment for her. But the details of her experience were so painful that we could no longer look past the violence. We started an investigation for which we interviewed over 50 women. We were truly shocked to see how widespread the problem of sexual violence had become. Several women had been raped and become pregnant. Even when DNA testing confirmed that male officers were the fathers of these children, very little was done about it. Some officers who had received multiple sexual assault complaints were temporarily reassigned to other duties or other prisons, only to wind up back at Tutwiler, where they continued to prey on women. We eventually filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice and released several public reports about the problem, which received widespread media coverage. Tutwiler made a list of the 10 worst prisons in America compiled by Mother Jones. It was the only women's facility to be so dishonored. Legislative hearings and policy changes at the prison followed. Male guards are now banned from the shower areas and toilets, and a new warden has taken over the facility. Marcia held on despite these challenges and started advocating for some of the younger women. We were devastated when the Court of Criminal Appeals issued a ruling affirming her conviction and sentence. We sought review in the Alabama Supreme Court and won a new trial based on the trial judge's refusal to exclude people from jury service who were biased and could not be impartial. Marcia and our team were thrilled. Local officials in Baldwin County, less so. They were threatening re-prosecution. We involved expert pathologists and persuaded local authorities that there was no basis on which to convict Marcia of murder. It took 2 years to settle the legal case and then another year of wrangling with the Department of Corrections to give Marcia full credit for the time she'd served before she was finally freed in December 2012 after 10 years of wrongful imprisonment. We had started holding annual benefit dinners each March in New York City to raise money for EJI. We usually honored a luminary in public service and a client. We'd previously honored Marion Wright Edelman, the heroic civil rights lawyer and founder of the Children's Defense Fund. In 2011, we honored retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. I had met Justice Stevens at a small conference when I was a young lawyer, and he had been extremely kind to me. By the time he retired, he'd become the court's most vocal critic of excessive punishment and mass incarceration. In 2013, along with Marcia Colby, we decided to honor the charismatic former director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Elaine Jones, and the progressive ice cream icons Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. Roberta Flack, the legendary singer and songwriter, agreed to perform. She sang the George Harrison tune, "Isn't It a Pity," before it was time to present our award to Marcia. In my introduction, I told the audience how, on the day of her release from Tutwiler, Marcia had come to the office to thank everyone. Her husband and her two daughters had picked her up at Tutwiler. Her youngest daughter, who was about 12, had reduced most of our staff to tears because she refused to let go of her mother the entire time she was in the office. She clung to Marcia's waist, kept hold of her arm, and leaned into her as if she intended to never let anyone physically separate them ever again. We took pictures with Marcia and some of the staff, and her daughter is in every shot because she refused to let her mother go. That told us a lot about what kind of mom Marcia Colby was. Marcia took the podium in her lovely blue dress. "I want to thank all of you for recognizing me and what I've been through. Y'all are being very kind to me. I'm just happy to be free." She spoke to the large audience calmly and with a great deal of composure. She was articulate and charming. She became emotional only when she talked about the women she'd left behind. "I am lucky. I got help that most women can't get. It's what bothers me the most now, knowing that they are still there and I'm home. I hope we can do more to help more people." Her gown sparkled in the lights, and the audience rose to applaud Marcia as she wept for the women she'd left behind. Following her, I couldn't think of what to say. "We need more hope. We need more mercy. We need more justice." I then introduced Elaine Jones, who began with, "Marcia Colby, isn't she a beautiful thing?"
Chapter 13. Recovery. Events in the days and weeks following Walter's release were completely unexpected. The New York Times covered his exoneration and homecoming in a front-page story.
We were flooded with media requests, and Walter and I gave television interviews to local, national, and even international press who wanted to report the story. Despite my general reluctance about media on pending cases, I believe that if people in Monroe County heard enough reports that Walter had been released because he was innocent, there would be less resistance to accepting him when he returned home. Walter was not the first person to be released from death row after being proved innocent. Several dozen innocent people who had been wrongly condemned to death row had been freed before him. The Death Penalty Information Center reported that Walter was the 50th person to be exonerated in the modern era. Yet few of the earlier cases drew much media attention. Clarence Brantley's 1990 release in Texas attracted some coverage. His case had also been featured on 60 Minutes. Randall Dale Adams inspired a compelling, award-winning documentary film by Errol Morris called The Thin Blue Line. The movie had played a role in Adams' exoneration, and he was released from Texas's death row not long after its release. But there had never been anything like the coverage surrounding Walter's exoneration. In 1992, the year before Walter's release, 38 people were executed in the United States. This was the highest number of executions in a single year since the beginning of the modern death penalty era in 1976. That number rose to 98 in 1999. Walter's release coincided with increased media interest in the death penalty, triggered by the increasing pace of executions. His story was a counter-narrative to the rhetoric of fairness and reliability offered by politicians and law enforcement officials who wanted more and faster executions. Walter's case complicated the debate in very graphic ways. Walter and I traveled to legal conferences and spoke about his experience and about the death penalty. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee scheduled hearings on innocence and the death penalty a few months after Walter's release, and we both testified. Pete Early's book, Circumstantial Evidence, was published a few months after Walter was freed, and it provided a detailed account of the case. Walter enjoyed the travel and the attention, even though he didn't much like speaking in public. Politicians would sometimes say provocative things, such as that his exoneration just proved the system works, which irritated and angered me. My own speaking would sometimes take on an edge of combativeness, but Walter remained calm, jovial, and earnest, and it was very effective, watching Walter tell his story with such good humor, intelligence, and sincerity heightened the horror our audiences felt, that the state had been determined to execute this man in all of our names. It was a compelling presentation. We spent a good bit of time together, and Walter would occasionally share with me that he was still troubled by the cases of the men he'd left behind on death row. He thought of the guys on the row as his friends. Behind his gentle presentations, Walter had become fiercely opposed to capital punishment, an issue he readily admitted he had never thought about until his own experience confronting it. A few months after winning his freedom, I was still nervous about Walter's return to Monroe County. The big feast immediately following his release had brought hundreds of people to his home to celebrate his freedom, but I knew that not everyone in the community was overjoyed. I didn't tell Walter about the death threats and bomb threats we'd received until he was free, and then I told him that we needed to be careful. He spent his first week out of prison in Montgomery. He then moved to Florida to live with his sister for a couple of months. We still talked almost every day. He'd accepted that many wanted to move forward without him and seemed mostly happy and hopeful. But that didn't mean that there were no after effects from his time in prison. He started telling me more and more about how unbearable it had been to live under the constant threat of execution on death row. He admitted fears and doubts he hadn't told me about when he was incarcerated. He had witnessed 6 men leave for execution while he was on the row. At the time of the executions, he coped, as the other prisoners did, through symbolic protests and private moments of anguish. But he told me that he didn't realize how much the experience had terrified him until he left prison. He was confused about why that would bother him now that he was free. Why do I keep thinking about this? He sometimes complained of nightmares. A friend or a relative might say something about how they supported the death penalty, just not for Walter, and he would find himself shaken. All I could tell him was that it would get better. After a few months, Walter very much wanted to return to the place he'd spent his whole life. It made me nervous, but he went ahead and put a trailer on property he owned in Monroe County and resettled there. He returned to logging work while we made plans to file a civil lawsuit against everyone involved in his wrongful prosecution and conviction. Most people released from prison after being proved innocent receive no money, no assistance, no counseling, nothing from the state that wrongly imprisoned them. At the time of Walter's release, only 10 states in the District of Columbia had laws authorizing compensation to people who had been wrongly incarcerated. The number has since grown, but even today, almost half of all states, 22, offer no compensation to the wrongly imprisoned. Many of the states that do authorize some monetary aid severely limit the amount of compensation. No matter how many years an innocent person has been wrongly incarcerated, New Hampshire caps compensation at $20,000. Wisconsin has a $25,000 cap. Oklahoma and Illinois limit the total amount an innocent person can recover to under $200,000, even if the person has spent decades in prison. While other states have caps of more than $1 million, and many have no cap at all, several states impose onerous eligibility requirements. In some jurisdictions, if the person lacks the support of the prosecuting attorney who wrongly convicted him, compensation will be denied. At the time Walter was set free, Alabama was not among the handful of states that provided aid to innocent people released from prison. The Alabama legislature could pass a special bill granting compensation to a person wrongly convicted, but that almost never happened. A local legislator introduced a bill seeking compensation on Walter's behalf that prompted the local press to report that Walter was seeking $9 million. The proposed legislation, of which Walter had no prior knowledge, went nowhere. But the news coverage about the possible $9 million payoff outraged people in Monroeville who still questioned his innocence and titillated some of Walter's friends and family, a few of whom started soliciting him aggressively for financial help. One woman even filed a paternity suit, falsely claiming that Walter was the father of her child, a child that was born less than 8 months after Walter's release. DNA tests confirmed that he was not the father. Walter at times expressed frustration that people didn't believe him when he told them he had received nothing. We pressed ahead in our efforts to get compensation for him through a lawsuit, but there were obstacles. Our civil suit ran up against laws that give police, prosecutors, and judges special immunity from civil liability in criminal justice matters. While Chapman and the state officers connected with the case now readily acknowledged Walter's innocence, they were unwilling to accept any responsibility for his wrongful prosecution and death sentence. Sheriff Tate, who seemed most active in Walter's wrongful pretrial placement on death row, and whose racist threats and intimidation tactics seemed the most actionable in a civil suit, reportedly accepted Walter's innocence upon his release, but then started telling people that he still believed Walter was guilty. Rob McDuff, an old friend of mine from Jackson, Mississippi, agreed to join our team for the civil litigation. Rob is a white native Mississippian whose southern charm and manner enhanced his outstanding litigation skills in Alabama courts. He had recently asked me to help him with an Alabama civil rights case involving law enforcement misconduct. That case involved a police raid on a nightclub in Chambers County, during which black residents had been illegally detained, mistreated, and abused by local authorities who refused to accept any responsibility for their misconduct. We ended up taking the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we ultimately won a favorable ruling. Walter's civil case would also go to the U.S. Supreme Court. We sued almost a dozen state and local officials and agencies. As expected, the defendants all claimed immunity for the conduct that had resulted in Walter's wrongful conviction. The immunity from civil liability given to prosecutors and judges is even greater than the protections provided to law enforcement officers. So even though it was clear that Ted Pearson, the prosecutor who had tried the case against Walter, had illegally withheld evidence that directly resulted in Walter's wrongful conviction, we would likely not succeed in a civil action against him. As he was the person most in charge of Walter's wrongful prosecution and conviction, it was hard to reconcile his immunity with his culpability in the whole affair. But there was little we could do. State and federal courts have persistently insulated prosecutors from accountability for egregious misconduct that results in innocent people being sent to death row. In 2011, the U.S. Supreme Court again reinforced the protections that shield prosecutors from accountability. A month before an inmate named John Thompson was scheduled to be executed in Louisiana, a crime lab report was uncovered that contradicted the state's case against him for a robbery murder that had taken place 14 years earlier. State courts overturned his conviction and death sentence, and he was subsequently acquitted of all charges and released. He filed a civil suit, and a New Orleans jury awarded Thompson $14 million. The jury found that the district attorney, Harry Connick Sr., had illegally suppressed evidence of Thompson's innocence and had allowed him to spend 14 years in prison for a crime he had not committed. Connick appealed the judgment, and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the award in a bitterly divided 5-4 decision. As a result of immunity law, the court held that a prosecutor cannot be held liable for misconduct in a criminal case even if he intentionally and illegally withheld evidence of innocence. The court's decision was strongly criticized by scholars and court observers, and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a compelling dissent. But Thompson did not get any money. We faced similar obstacles in Walter's case. After a year of depositions, hearings, and pretrial litigation, we eventually reached a settlement with most of the defendants that would provide Walter with a few $100,000. Walter's claim against Monroe County for Sheriff Tate's misconduct could not be settled, so we appealed the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. Law enforcement officers generally have no personal resources to pay damages to victims of misconduct, so the city, county, or agency that employs them is typically the target of any civil action that seeks compensation. That's why we had sought relief from Monroe County for the misconduct of its sheriff. The county took the position that even though the sheriff's jurisdiction is limited to the county, he's elected by people only in the county, and he's paid by the county, he's not an employee of the county. The county sheriff was an employee of the state of Alabama, the county claimed. State governments are broadly shielded from recovery for their employees' misconduct unless the employee works for an agency that can be sued. If Tate was a state officer, Monroe County would have no liability for his misconduct and no recovery would be possible from the state of Alabama. Unfortunately for Walter, the Supreme Court ruled that county sheriffs in Alabama are state officers. Again, in a close 5-4 decision, which limited our ability to recover damages for the most egregious misconduct in Walter's case. We ultimately reached settlement with all parties, but I was disappointed that we couldn't get more for Walter. Adding insult to injury, Tate went on to be reelected sheriff, and he remains in office today. He has been sheriff continuously for more than 25 years. While the money wasn't as much as we would have liked, it did allow Walter to restart his logging business. He loved getting back into the woods and cutting timber. He told me that it was working from morning until night, being outdoors that made him feel normal again. Then one afternoon, tragedy struck. He was cutting a tree when a branch dislodged and struck him, breaking his neck. It was a serious injury that left Walter in very poor condition for several weeks. He didn't have a lot of care available, so he came to live with me in Montgomery for several months while he recovered. He eventually regained his mobility, although the injury put an end to his ability to cut trees and perform difficult landscape work. I marveled at how he seemed to take it in stride. "I'll figure out something else to do when I get back on my feet," he told me. After a few months, he went back to Monroe County and started collecting car parts for resale. He owned the plot of land where he'd put his trailer and had become convinced, on the advice of some friends, that he could generate income with a junk business, collecting discarded vehicles and car parts and reselling them. The work was less physically demanding than logging and allowed him to be outdoors. Before long, his property was littered with busted vehicles and scrap metal. In 1998, Walter and I were asked to go to Chicago to attend a national conference where exonerated former death row prisoners were planning to gather. By the late 1990s, the evolution of DNA evidence had helped expose dozens of wrongful convictions. In many states, the number of exonerations exceeded the number of executions. The problem was so significant in Illinois that in 2003, Governor George Ryan, a Republican, citing the unreliability of capital punishment, commuted the death sentences of all 167 people on death row. Concerns about innocence in the death penalty were intensifying, and support for the death penalty in opinion polls began to drop. Abolitionists were becoming hopeful that more profound death penalty reform, or possibly a moratorium, might be achievable. Our time in Chicago with other exonerated former death row prisoners was energizing for Walter, who seemed more motivated than ever to talk about his experience. Around the same time, I started teaching at the New York University School of Law. I would travel to New York to teach my classes and then fly back to Montgomery to run EJI. I asked Walter to come to New York each year to talk with students, and it was always a powerful moment when he walked into the classroom. He was a survivor of a criminal justice system that had proven, in his case, just how brutally unfair and cruel it could be. His personality, presence, and witness said something extraordinary about the humanity of people directly impacted by systemic abuse. His first-hand perspective on the plight of people wrongfully convicted was deeply meaningful to students, who often seemed overwhelmed by Walter's testimony. He usually spoke very briefly and would give short answers to the questions posed to him, but he had an enormous effect on the students who met him. He would laugh and joke and tell them he wasn't angry or bitter, just grateful to be free. He would share how his faith had helped him survive his hundreds of nights on death row. One year, Walter got lost on the trip to New York, and he called to tell me that he couldn't make it. He seemed confused and couldn't offer a coherent explanation of what had happened at the airport. When I got back home, I went to see him, and he seemed his usual self, just a little down. He told me that his junkyard business wasn't going great. When he described his finances, it became clear he was spending the money we'd secured for him more quickly than seemed prudent. He was buying equipment to make his collection of cars simpler, but he wasn't generating the kind of revenue necessary to support the costs. After an hour or two of anxious talk, he relaxed a bit and seemed to return to the jovial Walter I'd come to know. We agreed that we would travel together on any future trips. Walter wasn't the only one who was facing new financial pressures. When a conservative majority took power in Congress in 1994, legal aid to death row prisoners became a political target, and federal funding was quickly eliminated. Most of the capital representation resource centers around the country were forced to close. We had never received state support for our work, and without the federal dollars, we faced serious financial challenges. We scraped along and found enough private support to continue our work. Teaching and increased fundraising responsibilities got piled on top of my bulging litigation docket, but somehow things progressed. Our staff was overextended, but I was thrilled with the talented lawyers and professionals we had working with us. We were assisting clients on death row, challenging excessive punishments, helping disabled prisoners, assisting children incarcerated in the adult system, and looking at ways to expose racial bias, discrimination against the poor, and the abuse of power. It was overwhelming, but gratifying. I received a surprising call one day from the Swedish ambassador to the United States, who told me that EJI had been selected for the Olof Palme International Human Rights Award. They invited me to Stockholm to receive it. I had studied Sweden's progressive approach to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders as a graduate student, and had long marveled at how focused on recovery their system appeared. Their punishments were humane, and their policymakers took rehabilitation of criminal offenders very seriously, which made me excited about the award and the trip. That they were giving an award named after a beloved prime minister who had been tragically murdered by a deranged man to someone who represented people on death row revealed a lot about their values. The trip to Stockholm was planned for January. They sent a film crew to interview me a month or two before the trip, and the crew also wanted to speak with a few clients. I made arrangements for them to interview Walter. "I can come down for this interview," I told Walter. "No, you don't need to do that. I don't have to travel, so I'm okay to talk to them. Don't spend time driving all the way down here." "Do you want to go to Sweden?" I asked, half-joking. "I don't know exactly where that is, but if you have to fly a long way to get there, no, I'm not too interested. I think I'd like to stay on the ground from now on." We laughed, and he sounded fine. He then became quiet and asked one final question before we hung up. "Maybe you can come and see me when you get back. I'm okay, but we can just hang out." It was an unusual request from Walter, so I eagerly agreed. "Sure, that would be great. We can go fishing," I teased. I'd never gone fishing in my life, and Walter found that so scandalous that he never stopped questioning me about it. When we traveled together, I never ordered fish to eat, and he was sure I didn't eat fish because I'd never caught a fish. I tried to follow his logic and made promises, but we had never gotten around to taking a fishing trip. The Swedish film crew was eager to meet the challenge of finding Walter's trailer in the backwoods of South Alabama. I told them how to get there. I'd always been with Walter when he spoke to the press, but I felt like this was probably safe. "He doesn't give speeches. He's usually very direct and succinct," I told the interviewers. "He's great, but you should ask him good questions. And it's probably better if you talk to him outside, too. He prefers to be outdoors." They nodded sympathetically but seemed confused by my anxiety. I called Walter before leaving for Sweden, and he told me that the interview had gone fine, which was reassuring. Stockholm was beautiful. Despite the constant snow and frigid temperatures, I gave some speeches and attended a few dinners. It was a short, cold trip, but the people were lovely and unusually kind to me. I was surprised at how gratifying I found their enthusiasm for our work. Most everyone I met offered support and encouragement. A couple of years earlier, I had been invited to Brazil to talk about punishment and the unjust treatment of disfavored people. I had spent a lot of time in local communities, mostly in the favelas outside São Paulo, where I met hundreds of desperately poor people who were intensely interested in talking. I spent hours in conversation with all sorts of people, from struggling mothers to impoverished children who sniffed glue to help them cope with hunger and police brutality. The cross-cultural conversations with those people, who had shared a lot of the same history and struggle as my client in America, had a huge impact on me. In Sweden, the people I met were equally interested and responsive, even though they hadn't experienced profound need or shared struggle with an abusive justice system. People all over the country seemed motivated to connect from a common place of tremendous compassion. The organizers asked me to speak at a high school on the outskirts of Stockholm. Kungsholmen's Gymnasium is in an extraordinarily beautiful section of Stockholm, an island surrounded by 17th century architecture. As an American with limited experience outside the United States, I was dazzled by the age of the buildings and marveled at their ornate architecture. The school itself was nearly 100 years old. I was escorted through the school to a narrow, winding staircase with handcrafted railings that led up to a cavernous auditorium. Several hundred high school students packed the room, waiting for my presentation. The domed ceiling of the enormous hall was covered with delicate hand paintings and Latin phrases written in decorative script. Floating angels and trumpet-wielding infants danced all over the walls and ceiling. A large balcony packed with more students seemed to ascend elegantly into the drawings. While the room was very old, the acoustics were perfect, and there was a balance and precision to the space that seemed almost magical. I studied the hundreds of Scandinavian teenagers seated in the hall while I was being introduced. I was impressed by how eager they appeared. I spoke for 45 minutes to the strangely silent and attentive group of teens. I knew English wasn't their first language and had real doubts about how much they were even following what I said. But when I finished, they erupted into vigorous applause. Their response actually startled me. They were so young, but so interested in the plight of my condemned clients thousands of miles away. The headmaster joined me on stage to thank me and suggested to the students that they offer their own thanks with a song. The school had an internationally famous music program and student choir. The headmaster asked the choir students to stand wherever they were in the auditorium and briefly sing something. About 50 giggling kids stood up and looked around at each other. After a minute of uncertainty, a 17-year-old boy with strawberry blonde hair stood on his chair and said something to his choir mates in Swedish. The students laughed, but they became more sober. As they became still and perfectly quiet, the boy hummed a note in a beautiful tenor voice. His pitch was perfect. Then he slowly waved his arms to prompt these extraordinary children to sing. Their voices bounced off the walls and ceiling of this ancient hall and fell into a glorious harmony, the likes of which I'd never heard. After starting his classmates in song, the young man stepped off his chair and joined them in performing a heartbreaking melody with tremendous care and precision. I could not understand a word of the Swedish lyrics, but it sounded angelic. Dissonance and harmonic tension slowly resolved into warm chords. The sound was transcendent. The singing built gloriously with each line. Standing on a stage above the singers with the headmaster beside me, I looked up at the ceiling, at the majestic artwork. My mother had died a few months before this trip. She'd been a church musician most of her life and had worked with dozens of children's choirs. When I looked up and saw the drawings of angels on the dome ceiling, I thought of her. I quickly realized I would never recover my composure looking up there, so I looked back at the students and forced a smile. When the students finished their song, the rest of the students cheered and applauded wildly. I joined the applause and tried to hold myself together. When I left the stage, students came up to thank me for the talk, ask questions, and take pictures. I was completely charmed. It was a long and exhausting but beautiful day. When I got back to the hotel, I was grateful for the 2-hour break before my next speaking commitment. I don't know what prompted me to turn on the television, but I'd been away from home for 4 days and hadn't seen any headlines. The local news blasted into my room. The unfamiliar Swedish TV anchors were chatting away when I heard my name. It was the piece the crew had filmed with me. Familiar images filled the screen. I watched myself walking with the reporter into Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s church on Dexter Avenue in Montgomery, then up the street to the Civil Rights Memorial. The scene then switched to Walter, standing in overalls amid his pile of discarded cars down in Monroeville. Walter gently put down a little kitten he'd been holding as he started to answer the reporter's questions. He'd mentioned to me previously that all kinds of cats had sought shelter in his field of abandoned metal. He said things I'd heard him say dozens of times before. Then I watched his expression change, and he began talking with more animation and excitement than I'd ever heard from him. He became uncharacteristically emotional. "They put me on death row for 6 years. They threatened me for 6 years. They tortured me with the promise of execution for 6 years. I lost my job. I lost my wife. I lost my reputation. I lost my dignity." He was speaking loudly and passionately and looked to be on the verge of tears. "I lost everything," he continued. He calmed himself and tried to smile, but it didn't work. He looks soberly at the camera.
It's rough. It's rough, man. It's rough.
I watched worriedly while Walter crouched down close to the ground and began to sob violently. The camera stayed on him while he cried. The report switched back to me saying something abstract and philosophical, and then it was over. I was stunned. I wanted to call Walter, but I couldn't figure out how to dial him from Sweden. I knew it was time to get back to Alabama.